TalkToTour.com podcast. My name is Justin Landon, and I am joined tonight by fantasy author Sam Sykes. We are just going to check in with him. I know he's got a few things that he needs to talk about.
So, Sam, I understand that there has been an issue in fictions that has been getting your gourd, so to speak. So why don't you talk to us about that?
Well, it's one of these weird things because, like, there are some aspects of fantasy that seem, like, really ingrained into the genre. And, like, you want to get them, but you just don't get them, you know? Like, for some people, it might just be the fascination with dragons.
Right.
Or some people, it might be, like, the idea of a prophecy. They just can't swallow it. I can't handle feast scenes.
Like, at all? Like, they just the mere mention of a sumptuous setting of food makes you uncomfortable or bored?
Like, I groan, and I'm like, oh, And I think it all goes back to the last, like, the time I became disenchanted with Brian Jacques, author of the Redwall series.
Right.
I read Outcast of Redwall, which was about a ferret who gets adopted into Redwall, Mossflower Abbey. Or is it Redwall Abbey?
I don't know. I'm sure, like, genre sacrilege, I've never read Redwall.
Well, see, like, you're having genre sacrilege having never read Redwall, but I'm about to, like, offer criticism to Redwall. So I think I'll probably be killed first.
Will you be subjected to red rum for...
But it was this story about a ferret who gets adopted to Redwall Abbey. And, you know, ferrets are vermin, and vermin are the enemies of the good mice and bunnies and whatnot of Redwall Abbey. Anyways, it was an interesting story, but it turns out, like, the ferret who is raised in a loving and nurturing environment is still, like, awful and hateful and evil. And I came away from that story, like, kind of with my mind blown. It was like, oh, that's a little weird. But anyways, anyone who's read Brian Jacques knows, like, he writes feast porn. Like, there is not a meal that is not described in 6 pages or less or more.
Okay, so this is true of several other writers. The George R. R. Martin, for one of them.
Of course.
Who enjoys a good feast scene.
Right.
What do you suppose the root of this is? I presume it's been a while since I've read Tolkien, but I believe that his work has a fair bit of description of food, beginning in the Shire and moving onward. Is this just something hearkening back to that, or do you think there's something baser in the human nature here that makes us want this?
Well, I'll tell you what. I was on a panel with a fellow you might have heard of named Brandon Sanderson. And we were talking about world building, and he actually brought up a point I had not considered, that a lot of what shapes a culture is their food and their rituals around eating food, you know?
Okay.
I thought, you know, hey, that sounds pretty reasonable. But, like, a lot of these feast scenes are just, like, what you would think of eating at a Renaissance fair. There's, like, a suckling pig and a glazed duck, and, like, a salad of some sort. And they are all washing it down with mugs of fizzleberry ale or whatever.
Have you ever noticed, speaking of weird things that we consume in fantasy, have you ever noticed how much wine is consumed at weird times of day? I mean, they drink that stuff all the time. Is that some kind of anachronistic thing where, like, people used to drink wine instead of water because water was tainted or something?
I feel it is that way, but here's, like, another thing with feast scenes is, like, I think it ties into this, is we are sort of relying on these tropes and taking them as granted without really establishing them in the world. Like, whenever they're drinking wine, they are just drinking wine because it's a fantasy novel. Like, at no point do they say, oh, hey, shouldn't we drink water? Like, no, man, the water's really gross here.
Yeah, that would be nice, right? Just sort of some recognition that, oh, man.
Right.
All of our latrines are, you know, upstream. We really don't want to do that.
Right.
Well, the other thing, too, is that I feel like the feast scene is become sort of one of those lazy stand-ins for opulence.
I believe you're right, and you know, like I said, I really enjoyed what Brandon had to say on that, but I noticed a lot of people weren't actually doing that. They were just sort of tossing in a feast scene of the same shit, and no one was really, like, there was no food lore going on there. Like, there was no ritual of who gets served first, there was no ritual of, like, passing tables or whatever, or no prayers invoked. I'm like, so, it does get kind of lazy, it sort of makes me feel like when someone was writing the fantasy novel, they're like, oh shit, I better make sure that they know this is a fantasy novel, let's throw in a feast scene.
Oddly, there are some epic fantasy writers that don't do this.
Yeah.
So, for example, I don't recall Robert Jordan getting much into feast porn, but like he was really into dress porn.
Yeah.
Am I wrong? I don't remember feast scenes in The Wheel of Time.
No, you're not wrong. I you know, since we're killing sacred cows here, I have not read a lot of Wheel of Time, so I could not recall. But it feels like a lot of authors do have one thing that they focus on, and like that's their mark. Like K.J. Parker is blacksmith porn. And
right.
Courtney Schaefer is rock climbing porn.
Right. Mark Lawrence is evil porn.
Despair porn.
Despair porn, yeah.
Yeah. Porn dark.
Right, yeah, no, I... yeah, no, I think that's interesting. And feast porn maybe just be kind of one of those things that manifests more frequently. I just skip those scenes normally, and I guess it's because I've become so ingrained not to expect actual world building in them.
I think that's right, and I kind of want to counteract myself here, in that I kind of understand why a lot of people put in feast scenes, and it's like the same reason I put in like ridiculous costumes or otherworldly races or monsters in my books, even though a lot of those are like fallen out of favor. It's a trope, and it's part of fantasy that I really enjoy. And, you know, I would say that a lot of feast porn writers do enjoy writing that, because, you know, they grew up with that, and it's really interesting to them. And I don't mind that. Like, I'm very much a fan of what Scott Lynch said about cliches, and that they're popular for a reason. But I think we are all waiting to see, like, what you can do with this cliche to make it your own. And I feel like that's an opportunity that gets wasted a lot.
I feel like somebody needs to really capitalize on this by actually using feast porn as a story plot point, right? And I guess
right.
I guess in some way George R. R. Martin already kind of did that with The Red Wedding, where it was set up to be another series of feast porning, where
right.
he completely undermines it by, you know, decapitating a favorite character. And
yeah, like that was the big deal there, was that the laws of hospitality had been violated.
Which I suppose, and this of course may be why this is either some of the best, you know, written books out there, is George does all of that feasting to set up that fact, right?
Yeah.
I guess. If he doesn't do all the feast porn prior to that, do we care as much about rules of hospitality and that kind of thing?
Yeah, and I would say he definitely did that well. And, you know, I'm sure a Brandon Sanderson novel, and if we had Brian McClellan here, he could probably tell us which Brandon Sanderson novel had, you know, some world building going on in that feast porn. But, yeah, it's something I don't see too often. And I feel like, you know, we have this conversation frequently in fantasy where we need to start expanding our horizons out of in regards to settings. Like, we want to stop doing not Europe as a setting, or, you know, like pseudo Europe. We want to move on to other sort of basic civilizations. And I think, you know, food porn is probably where you're going to establish a lot of that, because a lot of the feast porns these days are just straight up like European feasting, what we imagine when we imagine ye old times.
I'm really skeptical of the whole turkey leg thing.
Yeah, those are some big turkeys.
Well, and, you know, furthermore, it just does. It seems like in a society where not everybody has enough to eat, which is
right.
basically every time ever.
Right.
Although, you know, perhaps with modern times accepted, although certainly outside of the developed world, that's not the case. But like, it just seems like the turkey leg, we all know turkey leg is not the most healthy of meats.
Yeah.
And certainly not the most nutritious of meats. I just can't imagine that it would be the choice of the elite would be to eat a big, greasy turkey leg. And we always hear about that, you know, like the guy holding the turkey leg and gesturing with it and gnawing on it. It doesn't work for me. You know, I think a good solid turkey breast would be far more likely. And who knows, maybe I'm totally out of bounds here on historical accuracy. But as we always say, fantasy doesn't need to be historically accurate. That's why it's called fantasy.
So right.
I don't want to read about greasy turkey legs, man. Can we get some healthier meat products in front of these people?
So this like offends you on a whole nother level.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't mean to make maybe go too far with this because, you know, I don't want to diminish other concerns. But, you know, we always hear that, like, you know, it is we like to point to realism, which is why women don't have agency in fantasy. Right. Which is crap, obviously.
Right.
But
agreed.
And again, furthermore, it's fantasy. So even if it was true, it doesn't have to be true in our fantasy. Right. We can change the way these things work. And, you know, so even if it was true that they eat greasy, unhealthy turkey legs like it's candy in the olden times, in our fantasy, I think we can do better than that and present these muscle-bound guys as eating more lean meats, which would be more conducive to that kind of body sculpting. Just saying.
It would speak a lot as to the character as well as the world-building, wouldn't it? Like, you would not see an adventurer, you know, going out there fighting orcs or whatever, come home and eat a big greasy turkey leg and be like, that's delicious. He would probably throw up because that's like a lot more fat than he's used to.
This is a very interesting point that I have been wanting to discuss and never knew I wanted to discuss it.
Okay.
Have you ever seen a character in fantasy who is overtly health conscious?
No.
Like about what they eat, about getting enough exercise, about getting enough sleep, or like, there's never a character who's actually like worried about the condition of their health.
No.
On a day-to-day basis, not like I don't want to get my arm cut off, and we see that a lot, but like not on like treating the body as a temple. That's a character archetype that completely doesn't exist in our fantasy.
You know, I think it's more acceptable not to have that because even today, not a lot of people are aware of how to best treat their bodies.
Well, but people talk about it a lot, right? People obsess about it. Now, they don't do a very good job often, but like, tell me the last time you weren't, I mean, how often do you talk to somebody and they mention the words diet at some point in the conversation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would think that maybe characters in books don't do that for the same reasons we don't do that in real life. It's like, oh, wow, I need to eat healthy. But I'm running late, and, you know, McDonald's is right here, so blah.
I'm just saying, at some point, I would like to see a fantasy character that is actually actively trying to clean up their lifestyle to live a healthier lifestyle.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we often do see that archetype of the character who thinks the body is the temple, and you see that a lot in, like, the monk-type character. In fact, we saw this in Brian Stavely's novel, The Emperor's Blades. There was not a lot of diet mentioned there, but you do have that concept of the aesthetic, the person who is very interested about honing and improving themselves.
Right, although that aesthetic is often an aesthetic, right? Aesthetic. Somebody who is denying themselves as punishment almost, or like to train themselves to be without.
But
it is never sort of about like never about like just taking care of oneself. It's about denying myself to make myself more rugged.
Yeah, I think it's because like it's very hard to make like a health conscious guy sound interesting.
Well, I think that's
heroic because like we don't think of that already.
That's possible. I would also posit perhaps that the very antithesis of wish fulfillment.
Oh yeah,
is somebody who must diet and exercise to be the ideal of all things for men or women.
That is true. We don't like to acknowledge that you have to work for a lot of this.
And so I suppose from that perspective, that it's the same reason we don't do a lot of things in fantasy that might make sense. It's because nobody really wants to read about that kind of person.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I don't think it's a sin to want the audience to have fun.
Oh, here we go again. Why don't you grind that stone some more, Sam?
Well, I'm just saying, I could create a character who is very health conscious, but I feel like it would be a challenge to make him interesting. It's like, let's go slay the dragons. Is everyone all right with that? It's like, yes, I have my bow. Yes, I have my axe. Hang on, guys. Let me imbibe my protein shake first.
I have to do my pre-workout.
I need to do my pre-workout. I need to...
Or hold on, guys. I'm in the middle of a cleanse. I need to hit the head.
I'm in a juice cleanse this week. I'm really trying to avoid carbs and dragons.
So I feel like you need to take CrossFit and Paleo Diet Guy.
Oh my god!
And put him into a fantasy setting as a short story and just see what happens. I'm not saying,
but like, no one likes that guy already. So.
This would be a great. This is like we don't have enough humor in science fiction and fantasy anymore. And I feel like actual genuine humor, you know, which I was reminded of with the passing of Terry Pratchett.
Of course,
it's just that. It's just that doesn't exist anymore. There's so little of it.
Well,
the genuine humorism, not like there are funny bits in more serious books or moments of levity, but real humorism, real humorist fantasy is gone. I mean. How many humorists are writing in the field anymore? I don't really think there aren't really any. You know, maybe a few that dabble here and there, but nobody that makes a career of it.
Yeah, I would say I'm definitely a dabbler, but you know, I've had a lot of people praise my books for their funny parts, but they are not all funny, and in fact, the humor there exists to make the sad parts sadder.
Right. And where it's interesting with the real humorist, it's almost like the sad bits sort of offset the humor, you know.
Yeah.
It's like Terry Pratchett will get serious on you, all of a sudden you're like, whoa, where'd that come from?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are, you know, that's a very common common thing in storytelling, is, you know, you break up the tension to let the audience both catch their breath and to put them off guard for when the next heavy bit comes.
Yeah, I would like to see more humor, though. I would really love, Tom Holt, I guess, is kind of trying to write that stuff. I think Tom Holt's a little too smart sometimes for his own good.
Yeah.
Sometimes your humor needs to be a little more obvious.
You listening to that, Tom Holt?
but his stuff can be really entertaining, but there just aren't a lot of those folks left anymore.
Well, and you know, maybe that's one of the reasons that made Terry Pratchett so very special. And, you know, I felt like Terry Pratchett's death, while tragic, was not sort of met with the wailing and cutting of foreheads that usually happens with these, because even though he's gone, like, he left a crater of an impact on fantasy. And it's not even a matter that we need to look for what needs to fill that. Maybe we can just let that be his legacy. And, you know, if someone comes along that does it like him or reminds us of him, that's great. But I am a big fan of sort of letting his legacy speak. Ugh,
I don't
things got unexpectedly deep there. You could fulfill a lot of traditions that are common in fantasy. And in fact, we are, you know, I once gave you shit over praising someone for paying homage to tradition. And you can indeed do a lot of that, but you kind of can't do it with comedy. You almost like can't teach comedy. It's very instinctive, and it's very it's very like a lot of trial and error. I was not around when I hadn't even gotten into Terry Pratchett's books when he was like out there, so I have no idea or if he was an instant classic, or if people were like, what the hell is this? But, you know, I bet he had to deal with a lot of boos. You know, any comedian will tell you, like, you have to bomb eventually.
It's true. I actually gave so I'm a little worn out today. I had to teach a 4.5-hour class today on politics. And so one of the components of that class was an hour class about political ads and how they, and how they work and how they could be impact. And I said, every ad that we're going to watch today, you'll notice the funny ones are the worst ones. Not because they aren't kind of funny sometimes, but because it's so hard to be funny and effective at the same time. Like, it's so hard.
Oh my God, yes.
It's easy to be funny. It's easy to make a joke, right? But it's hard to make a joke that makes a point.
Well,
effectively, right? That people can all, and it isn't a dick move. It isn't like, it has to be universally appealing, make your point, and still be funny. I just think that is, there's nothing harder than that.
God, there are a few things more painful than watching a politician try to be funny.
So true.
They, Sean Hannity today asked for people to tweet, Ted Cruz their questions. I couldn't resist. I asked him, when the United States was going to recognize the, the sacred union between a man and his anime wife. And some people got super mad at me. Yeah, so basically, summary of thoughts on Terry Pratchett is like, I am not in a hurry to find his successor as much as I might miss him. Like, I feel that when the time is right, we will have another person who does humorism well.
That sounds eerily like the return of Arthur in ancient Arthurian legend. When we need him, he will emerge, or she will emerge.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in that you can't actually force a reader to take your point. Like, you have to let them figure it out. And I find a lot of people are really angry when readers don't get their point. In fact, readers aren't listening because someone trying to make a point tends to be kind of dull. So I feel like Terry Pratchett sort of let you figure out the point. He was just sort of like, he was pointing at it rather than like jamming it in your face.
I like that. Yeah. Very eloquent, Sam.
Yeah, this began as a very funny episode, but now it's gotten quite serious.
Maybe we'll cut out the serious shit and just leave in the funny.
We'll leave in the funny. Yeah, like all, well, don't do that, because like, this is all good stuff.
Do you think Terry Pratchett had a lot of feast scenes? I don't think I've read enough Pratchett to determine whether or not he was into feasting.
I did not either. There needs to be like a database of the authors who are food porny.
All right, Sam, this has been a good talk about feast scenes now, but I think we need to go to our feast scene correspondent, Delilah S. Dawson.
Nom 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 nom.
Oh, wow.
That's actually really good.
You do have to be careful though, because when you say feast scene, it almost sounds like feces. So
we could talk about feces if you want.
This is an interesting point. There are lots of feast scenes, but there are very few feces scenes. Like, how many scenes in a fantasy book have people taking dookies?
I will weigh in there, and I think that is. I am happy to just assume they are pooping.
So you're saying this, does this get sort of into the same category? So Sam also argued that he was, I got very upset that in the feast scenes, Delilah, that there is no, nobody's ever health conscious in fantasy books. Like nobody's ever like.
Well, that's because it's a feast. It's not a, like a careful salad bar.
Yeah, but nobody's ever like, no, I don't want the greased capon. That's rather fatty. Please pass the white meat. You know what I mean?
Well, sometimes like, it is, but it's always like a woman who is concerned. Like, that's I'm about to marry somebody and I don't want to vomit on his legs. And then.
Right, but like, these well-conditioned athletes, you know, like, the Viper of Dorne or whatever from Song of Ice and Fire, wouldn't he be like, no, I'm not going to eat this heavy meal because I need to be, you know, live for my encounter with the mountain that rides? Like, there's no awareness of this.
And I also think it's because that's a really boring idea.
Feces scenes, you're saying feces scenes would fall into the same category of like just nobody wants to read about that?
I don't know if nobody wants to. I'm saying I am perfectly happy not to.
No, nobody.
You know, like I got shit from the book smugglers because they're like, oh, there's no real detailed system of them oh, there's no real detailed scenes of anyone eating. And I'm like, well, all right, but do you assume they're not eating or what? How much do we need to lay out before this is realistic?
Delilah, Salmon makes a lot of fart jokes in his book, so I feel like his aversion to feces is a little strange.
Well, I mean, that's like the clean version of shitting.
I'm not saying I'm averse to feces. I'm just saying if they're not there, I'm totally fine with assuming that someone is shitting.
But isn't like the whole nature of the epic fantasy to fill in all kinds of details that we didn't need?
That's true, but I mean, I have some issues with that as well. Like, I don't need to necessarily know the economics of trading millstones.
Well, see, this is one of the many things that bothers me about, like, the sword and sorcery that has the women in the chain bikinis, where you're like, that woman's, she's going to spend 5 days per month menstruating. Like, does she just conspicuously remove the metal floss bikini for those days and, like, put on a pair of, like, metal granny panties and be like, oh.
Well, I mean, like, I've read my share of urban fantasies, and I don't see a lot of menstruation going on there either, you know, with female protagonists. I'm not going to blame someone for opting to exclude the part of their life that they wish they did not have to deal with.
That's true, and yet at the same time, in urban fantasy, it's in our world, so these things can conceivably be hidden pretty well through modern products you can purchase easily and clothes that can hide them easily. But like, if you're riding a horse with a group for a month, like, it's an issue. The blood will draw wild animals. And so when people sometimes conspicuously leave it out, it feels like a problem to me. It doesn't ring as true, which maybe that's why.
Oh boy.
Well, this also feels like something that some fantasy author could shoehorn in. Well, you know, under stressful conditions, women may not menstruate for up to 4 months. I've done copious research on this subject.
We need like one of Douglas Adams' babblefish. You just shove that thing up there and it takes care of everything.
Well, I feel like this is one of those situations where you simply can't win.
No, but you can't.
If you don't take the time to describe menstruation, then that's certainly, that does make it not ring as true. But if you take the time to describe menstruation, then you have just taken the time to describe menstruation. And people,
I'm just saying describing versus acknowledging. Like, you have to acknowledge where the people are taking their shits.
It's true, though, because the only time we talk about it in books is when it gets missed due to some sort of, like, promiscuous sex thing that happened. Yeah. Like, it's only mentioned when convenient.
You're going to get shamed either way.
But I mean,
well,
like,
it's like Wake of Vultures. I just finished the copy edits for it. Like, you're on a horse for a month. I had to mention it. Like, the girl's pretending to be a dude.
Oh, boy. I think that makes perfect sense, though, because that is active. Like, a big part of the story is pretending to be a dude and ostensibly hiding the parts of you that are feminine. So, yeah, you would definitely need to acknowledge that. Whereas, I'm not sure anyone reads a Sam Sykes books for the thrilling acknowledgement of menstruation.
I will say.
I would say.
Yeah, I actually would really enjoy seeing Kataria dealing with this issue.
No, because shit.
You could call it the Red Wedding.
Oh, boy. Oh, it's a bad time when Sam Sykes is the cleanest mouth on the panel. Oh, well, no, I actually do have an answer to that, which actually did come up in Mortal Tally.
So you take this issue head on.
Well, you know, like, Schicks are a nomadic hunter-gatherer society. They probably can't breed all around because a lot of nomadic peoples had issues raising children or birthing because of the fact that they were always on the move. So I thought it would make more sense for a separate race to sort of have more, more stringent breeding periods, like mating seasons.
No, I did that too in the Blood Books.
Yeah, so that's it. So they only breed like once every at certain points of the year.
Is this cultural, or do they like only ovulate like at certain times?
I have not gone that deep yet because, again, it's like That's a because most of, when this comes up, it's being talked about between two Schick-ish women, so they don't really you know, they both know what each other is talking about.
You didn't pull a "so as you know, Bob."
So as you know about my vagina.
Oh God, we got to quote you on that one, Sam.
Well, it's not like it's like, you know, when people are describing sloppy storytelling, they say, "Boy, I sure am tired of these Star Wars." be like, someone saying, "Boy, I sure am having problems with my vagina today."
Oh, Jesus, dude. Yeah, I've taught some classes with some first-time epic fantasy writers, and it is, there's so much like, "Well, as you know, Bob, on Christmas we exchange gifts with our friends to celebrate the crucifixion of our Savior."
Yeah.
You know, like, where you're just like, "Honey, no."
Well, see, and that's, that's, you know, to actually get into a point there, this is one of the reasons that epic fantasy frequently feels hollow, is because our insistence on filling out those little details kind of robs us of some genuine characterization. Like, I at no point do I say, like, "Merry Christmas, Delilah. As you know, this is the year where this is appropriate for this time of year because blah, blah, blah." I say, "Merry Christmas, Delilah," and she says, "I don't celebrate Christmas," or something.
What's interesting about that? Wow. If you look at other writers outside of epic fantasy, like, say, Kim Stanley Robinson and his science fiction, like, he has, like, perfected the info dump into an art form where, like, he makes sure to have a narrative device in all of his books where he can just turn off the action, turn off the story.
Right.
And just separate and dump what information he has to and then come back to the story. And actually, in Ken Liu's new book, Grace of Kings, it's not as overt as Kim Stanley Robinson, but he uses a narrator that zooms in and out and lets him do, like, these macro world building moments before he goes back into the character. Right. So that was actually a really cool way to deal with it. As opposed to dumping it into the text awkwardly, or, like, I hate it when it's like a first person narrator and they're, like, walking down the street.
Oh God.
And they're talking to themselves about, like,
"I remember when I was a child, I saw a Volkswagen once."
I am more forgiving of that than most, but I do agree it's awkward.
Which it always strikes you as, like, why are you writing this book first person if you have to describe this stuff this way? You know what I mean? It's like, just don't do first person.
Yeah, but I also feel like describing, like, planning all these things out sort of robs us of that moment of immersion where it's to get sort of nerdy right now. I've been playing Blood Bowl, which is it's a action game that sort of gives you.
Did you say Blood Butt?
Blood Bowl. You idiot.
Blood what?
Oh my God, Justin.
Blood what? I can't hear you. Say it again.
Bloodborne.
Bloodborne. Oh, I don't know what that
Delilah
is.
Delilah heard it.
Oh, Bloodborne. It's about Swedish bears that bleed.
No, it is Bloodborne, and it's a story in which you are this thing called a beast hunter, and you are killing just horrible creatures in this ancient city. And at no point is there a bestiary or them describing what you're killing. You just sort of piece it together. And so the first time you see something, you have this moment of like, what the fuck is that? And you slowly learn what it does and how it's hanging out as you encounter more of them. And I really enjoy that in books where, you encounter something and you're like, what the fuck is that? And you learn more about it as you go. You know, I thought Brandon Sanderson did that pretty well in Mistborn with these mist wraiths coming out. It's like, oh, this, whenever someone mentioned mist wraiths, I thought, oh God, that sounds bad. And then we saw one and like, that is bad. And then we're like, oh, it's actually some large kind of symbiotic parasite. That's cool. And I feel like when you sort of lay down everything right off the bat, it's like, well, that sounds like it could have been cool.
The number of times I've had to say to a beginner writer, yes, but you're not Brandon Sanderson. Like, he's earned that and we trust him.
Well, yeah, he has had many books to perfect that.
Yeah. Yeah. So most people can't accomplish that with that kind of deftness.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, I'm willing to forgive. I am willing to forgive just about anything so long as I'm having fun.
Mm.
And yeah. I will forgive clumsiness all the time so long as it's enthusiastic. So, naturally, I won't, I had a bad joke, but since I'm being the polite one, I'm going to avoid that. But basically, yeah, obviously you can't start out at Sandersonian levels. But you can get there, and it certainly doesn't hurt to try. And the only way you're going to get there is by trying.
True.
So, but you know, I don't mind an info dump now and then, but I prefer to be delighted.
Do you know that we had a panel title at Worldcon in London titled "The Pleasures of a Good Long Info Dump"?
Oh God!
Oh Jesus!
Were the panelists as long-winded as that would suggest?
I don't know.
Who were the panelists?
I didn't attend that panel. I don't recall who was on it, but I think it was mostly science fiction writers who sort of. I think that's one of the differences between science fiction and fantasy is like you can get away with info dumping in science fiction a lot easier than you can in fantasy, and I think that's because science fiction is less about immersion often.
Yeah. Well, with science fiction, there's a lot of idea. People want to know the concept right away. Like, what makes this one different? Or so I assume.
Well, so what's interesting is you talk about Sanderson, and Sanderson does info dump pretty heavily when it comes to his magic systems, which are kind of science fictional in like that they have rules and stuff, and he dumps that stuff. But he doesn't. Right. He doesn't tend to dump like sort of world building details or character details. Like he's very good about revealing those slowly. But like I think he utilizes the info dump well when he needs to, and I think that's kind of what you're talking about, Delilah, is finding that medium between like what I have to dump and what I don't have to dump.
Yeah.
And knowing when.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point because a lot of us, we don't necessarily read Brandon Sanderson solely for the magic systems, but when you say Brandon Sanderson, of course, the first thing you're going to think of is magic systems. And so I don't think it's wrong of him to just throw that out there. Like, this is the new mechanic. This is what I'm doing. Have fun with it, and then sort of dole out the more juicy bits as we go on. So he,
you know, I think that's one reason why steampunk never took off. It's like it felt like people were trying. You know, we tell people to skip the info dump, I guess, and things that aren't a big fantasy or science fiction. But in steampunk, it's like people wanted to jump right into the main action and just throw on a pair of goggles and assume it was done, but you'd get into that and without any kind of a preamble or an understanding of the magic or the technology, suddenly like everyone's wearing goggles and shooting ray guns, and it felt discombobulating and also kind of ineffectual.
It's sort of like the main criticism of steampunk cosplay. It's like just take a coat and glue gears to it and there you go. Yeah. So maybe perhaps that became an issue with the fiction itself, is everyone just sort of said, oh, fuck it, take a regular steampunk story and glue gears on it.
Well, I think the biggest issue there is just that steampunks don't buy books. They want to wear shit that makes people notice them. They don't want to, like, quietly read books.
Yeah, no one wants that.
Well, so I actually think one of the biggest failures of steampunk, I love how we have decided to just run roughshod over every genre. By the end of this, we'll have tackled,
like,
all the problems.
We might as well offend everyone.
That's right.
Well, like, steampunk's not a genre. Like, it's not. There's no shelf.
Right. I think the problem with steampunk was that it became a milieu and not like a book type. Like,
yeah.
It became a setting, not a structure. Like, epic fantasy has a structure and a setting, and it's a recognizable thing. Like, steampunk is just like it's a descriptor, not like an actual thing.
Yeah, you can't walk into Barnes & Noble and say, where is your steampunk section? And then see, you know, the romance and the science fiction and the fantasy all together. It's kind of spread out.
Right.
You just have to look for idiots with gears on them and bizarre goggles.
Like, there are steampunk epic fantasies and there are steampunk PNRs.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they have nothing in common other than the milieu. And even then, probably not. And so I think that was one of the things. Everybody tried to make it a genre. And, like, it's not a genre. It's a style.
Right. But I mean, it was doing really well for a while there.
They thought it was.
I feel like there was a time when I could not look anywhere without saying, oh, what, you know, there's some guy with a cigar saying, what do you got for me, kid? Has it got dirigibles? Does it got flintlocks or steam or whatever?
But who made money at it?
Gail Carriger.
Yeah, Gail. Uh-huh.
Sherry Priest.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, see, I feel like if Bone Shaker, if that movie had gotten made, that steampunk could have had a chance.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, the Bone Shaker, I haven't I'm only going off sort of my touchstone on Boneshaker because I've not read it, but like Boneshaker and Gale Carriger are both steampunk, but they don't really have that much in common, right? Like, they're not the same era. They're not the same, because one's Victorian. Isn't Boneshaker more like post-apoc?
It is, and the flavor is very different.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what's weird about it. It's like, yeah, okay, they've got kind of clockwork and stuff, but it's not the same thing.
Well, it sounds like Care and Memory by Elizabeth Baer is doing pretty decently, and Beth Cato's book, and...
Yeah, Clockwork Dagger, or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Care and Memory's great. It's a really good book. And, of course, I think it works because it's not a steampunk book. It's a historical urban fantasy that has clockwork.
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel like that's... Well, like, Gale's books are like, lighthearted adventure books.
Yeah.
They just have a steampunk flair to them.
I think hers also, I felt like I read both of her series through. I've read all of her books. But when I read Soulless, it felt like a romance. And so I was kind of disappointed in later books that there was no romance. Like, they were just firmly together and everything was coolio, and then they had a baby. So I wonder how many people were looking at that series for a romance and ended up with kind of a female-headed urban fantasy that felt very settled because she was kind of nailed down with Lord Mackin. But again, it's because, like, steampunk, like, there's no genre. You don't know what to expect. You pick up a PNR with a big vampire dude on the front, you know what's going to happen. But you pick up a book with someone in steampunk, you have no idea if it's going to be an adventure or a horror or what.
Which is, like, the whole reason genre exists. So that there's, you know, that expectations match up with what you get. And
yeah.
I think when a book doesn't do that, it only goes one of two ways. Either it's so amazing that nobody gives a shit that it didn't meet their expectations, or like it becomes the book that somebody picks up and says, I'm never reading that genre or that author again.
Oh. Yeah.
You know,
there was a time when we all seemed to be very interested in like saying, oh, this is it. This bust the genre, it subverts all the tropes. But they never really seem to last, do they? Like, we enjoy our tropes, we nerds.
Well, and not to open this can of worms, but that's been kind of the weird irony of this whole sad puppy thing.
Yeah.
Is like, they keep, that, you know, one of the things they're really pushing for is like this idea of like very commercial and tropey, if you will, fiction that they think is being ignored by the Hugo, which I kind of laugh at because, like, let's be honest, like, the things that win the Hugo are pretty fucking tropey, but and commercial, but
I mean, Red Shirts won,
right? It doesn't get any more of that than that.
Yeah, but that was a love letter to Star Trek.
Yes,
was...
and really a love letter to the nerds that love Star Trek. But
pretty much, yeah.
The funny thing about all this,
sloppy kiss.
Is like the reason the sad puppy thing, I think, if you remove sort of the Gamergate angle, the reason it resonates at all is because I actually think there are a significant number of science fiction and fantasy fans that really do want the genre to be that predictable. Like, that's what they want. Like, they want books that are just like the books they've always read. And that's, I don't know if that's true of genre, of SFF. I think that's true of a lot of readers, like romance readers and thriller readers and mystery readers, like, they really just want more of the same. It seems, I mean, until they don't, but I don't know.
Well, I think it's almost a lot like a meal. You know, you want your drink and then your appetizer and then your dinner and then your dessert. If there's no dessert, you get fucking pissed off. Which is, you know, in romance, if you don't get that happily ever after, at least a happily ever now, like, your readers will tear you limb from limb.
Hmm. Yeah.
But romance also isn't as, I mean, science fiction and fantasy is supposed to be about pushing limits, as far as I thought, and envisioning new things. So it seems hard to, there's nothing to nail down like a happily ever after. Like, you want satisfaction, but there's no, this has to happen at the end of the book.
Science fiction and fantasy is the fiction of ideas, but it's not the fiction of literature, right? Like, it's a fiction of ideas. And so the ideas need to be new and interesting, but the structures and the expectations actually, the book is more successful because it's doing something you've never seen before on the idea side. Everything else has to be the same. So you're not overwhelmed with like newness and confusion. And like, I think that's why books like Steven Erikson's Malazan Book of the Fallen, which granted is very popular, but it's also very hard to get into because it's this really challenging structure, and it's like these enormous ideas, and it's like overwhelming to people, you know?
It is intense, man. Like, I almost think it's something genetic. You either get it or you don't.
Right. Totally.
I have tried so hard. So hard. And it I can't. Any Malazan fans out there, I'm sorry. You don't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But like, in a nice way. I'm not passing judgment. I'm kind of envious that some people can get this, because they look really cool. And when I read it, I'm like, wow, cool races and weird magic and monsters. I like all this stuff, but then I can't understand it.
Yeah, like, I love it. It's one of my favorite series of all time, but like, I fully recognize that the first book is like one of the worst fantasy books ever written. You know what I mean? Like, it's terrible. It's so hard to read. It's this florid prose and dense world building and nonsense scenes that don't go anywhere. But like,
it sounds like fruitcake.
It pretty much is, but somehow it worked eventually. But like, that, I think that's the thing, is that book is a huge challenge, because it throws so much shit at you. And I think that's why sometimes science fictional and fantasy books are so simple, because the ideas are complicated, but the book needs to be simple, I guess, to make it more palatable. I don't know.
When you think about that, like, we talk about George R.R. Martin gets to kill more people than anyone else. Like, I have not finished the first book, because once Khal Drogo died, I was like, I'm done. Like, I don't care anymore. So put it down. Like, I think I finished the first season of the TV show because, like, the visuals are pretty, but, like, it feels like he broke the trope of letting beloved characters live, and I was just done. So I still have not finished it.
Well, see, I had the weirdest experience with, and I want to say, I can't say for sure, but I think a lot of readers had the same experience that I did, in that I, at the end of the first book, I was like reading ahead, looking for like the magic spell or the trick or something that showed me Ned Stark was actually alive and they were going to take it back to those mean old Lannisters. But it was like, nope, he's actually dead. And like, oh, because up until that point, I had been reading, like Drizzt novels where things are decided by D&D rules. So like, even if you get smacked by a giant dragon, you had 120 hit points, so you're okay.
A saving throw for sudden death.
Yeah, you did a saving throw to shit yourself, and you didn't shit yourself, so you're okay.
But we didn't talk about you shitting yourself, because that wouldn't be interesting.
I feel like if you failed your roll against sudden death, you would shit yourself. And, you know, Robert Baratheon mentioned, they never talk about the times they shit themselves. So, R.A. Salvatore, if you're listening, this does not ring true to the human experience.
So, actually, you bring up Robert Baratheon. I wrote a post once about how I don't think we handled like non-violent death very well in science fiction and fantasy. Like, it's something that we just sort of gloss over a lot. We don't talk about it. It's just either you die in a glorious, you know, charge of the light brigade, or you don't. And they don't really talk about it. But George R.R. Martin, like, nails the Robert Baratheon death. You know, like, gored by a bull. He's, like, wasting away. You can smell the shit that's leaking out of his entrails. Like, I mean, it's really good. And it's weird when I talk, like, what we just talked about, it's the ideas, and then you kind of back up on the structure. Like, George is that rare book where it's, like, he does everything different. Everything's different in that book.
Well,
it works.
I feel that's because George actually set out with the intent to upset you. And this is something I notice coming up more and more often, in that I see a lot of people on Twitter saying, like, I don't want to be upset by what I read. And I'm like, fair enough. You know, totally. There's no reason why you should be. Why you should want to read something that makes you uncomfortable or anything like that, especially if you encounter that shit in your real life. But I think a book that actually does upset you can have a very lasting impact on you. Because that was my experience with Game of Thrones, is like, Ned Stark dying actually upset me. Like, I was not used to a world where the good guys could lose. But like, that, I couldn't not look at it. So I had to keep going. And I feel like a lot of the best books, the ones that really endure, they kind of seize you in that uncomfortable way. They kind of grab you and shake you around a little. Like, a more recent example was Brian Staveley, who wrote Emperor's Blade. And a character in that died that I really did not want to die. And I actually had to set the book aside for a while and be like, oh my god, I can't, I'm so upset. But then I kept thinking about it all the time. And I couldn't not see how it ended. So I went, and it was just one of the best books I'd read in a long time.
I've got a couple series where whenever a book comes out, I have to turn to the last page and make sure that the important characters live through it. And when the day comes that they don't, I don't know what I'm going to do.
I think we've gotten to the point, at least in fantasy, epic fantasy in particular, and it's like 100% to the credit of the GURM, but like we don't expect people to live anymore.
Yeah, and that's another issue, isn't it? Is like, I've heard this criticism about Game of Thrones, is that you never get attached to anyone anymore, so the deaths aren't really shocking.
Yeah, no, I think that's a big shift. I mean, if you look at, you know, Abercrombie's books or Cameron Hurley's books, I mean, I have the full expectation that everybody I like is going to end up either dead or worse off than they started.
See, here's the great thing about Abercrombie. Is that I'm thinking back to the first law, and I actually can't remember a lot of guys who died except for, you know, like in what I consider to be the main party. Like a lot of the Northmen died, but I think one of the great things that Joe did was that everyone lived, but they kind of wish they had died instead, because it seems like it might have been easier.
Yeah.
Because Logan walks away, and you know he didn't change.
Well, although of course in that trilogy you don't know if Logan walks away. I mean, he does leave that on a cliffhanger.
Yeah, that's true. But you know, at the end, you know, Logan set out to be a good man, and it's like, I'm gonna change. I'm not gonna kill anyone. He's like, oh no, nope, I killed everyone. Spoiler alert: everyone dies.
Hashtag spoilers. So as Delilah, as the author of a forthcoming epic fantasy novel,
woohoo,
titled Wake of Vultures by your alternate ego, Lila Bowen.
Lila Bowen, I tell you what. Sorry.
See, it sounds Western.
Is your author photo going to be you with like a cocked cowboy hat?
No, I actually, my original thought was that this would be the book where I could be Dick Manley and have my author photos taken in drag.
You could have like a pipe and everything.
Well, I was going to go for like a 5 o'clock shadow in a fedora.
Yeah. No.
But,
not.
No, that's the author picture where I just look like an angry spy.
I would look, I actually do really want you to take a picture of yourself with a fedora, like tipping it towards the audience as if to say, my lady.
And then I'll go on Tinder.
And then you'll go on.
Swipe right.
Oh, God.
And then you will be euphoric.
But as the author of Epic Fantasy, and no spoilers, obviously. I mean, I don't even think there's a synopsis of your book out yet. What do you come down on this character dying thing? I mean, you've already said that like you like to have characters live. I mean, that's.
I'm almost going for almost a like Buffy the Vampire Slayer feel as far as the first book is like the Scooby Gang coming together. So there are people who die, and some of them are important, but...
Did you say the Scooby Gang?
She did.
Yeah.
She did.
So,
I hope Velma's the pro tag.
Yeah, like, I'm not gonna be mad if there isn't, but is there a talking dog?
I haven't written book two yet, so I wouldn't...
Can you include a talking dog?
No, there is. There are two.
Dang!
There you go.
Can you name him Sam?
There is a character named Sam. I have named characters after all of you.
Is he a talking dog?
Sam is not a talking dog. Neither is Jitty.
There's a what?
There's a Jitty.
Really?
Yes, there is.
The Jidster?
So, hey Delilah, is Hit out yet?
Hit is out next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
Yeah, so I've got three events next week.
Awesome. So you're hitting the book trail?
I am hitting the liquor because there's a lot of stuff to do. But yeah, I'm up in DC right now. So I've got three things up here in like the Washington, DC, North Virginia area. And then I head back down to Atlanta and do stuff there.
How's the reception so far?
I guess Kirkus liked it, which is a big deal for YA stuff because they let you know if they don't like it.
But oh, yeah.
I'm purposefully not reading reviews, just trying to get everything done. And like I had Wake of Vultures copy edits are due the day before Hit launches, so I've been too worried about that.
You better do them.
I did. They're like in the thing to mail tomorrow. I don't want Davey mad at me. Are you joking?
She's gonna get mad at you.
She's not.
She will.
You're gonna be there early.
She's not gotten mad at you?
No.
I'll ask her to.
No, I don't react well to being mad at. I don't need another excuse to eat chocolate because it's like half price right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wait, so
is that your ideal feast scene?
No, I like cake. I'm into cake.
Oh, let's bring this full circle. Speaking of feast scenes, does Wake of Vultures have a feast scene?
No, Wake
does
of Vultures...
Does it have feces?
The horses are shitting constantly because they're horrible animals, but... No, there's not a feast scene because it's all kind of like out in the desert. Like, I mean, it's Lonesome Dove-esque in the kind of we're constantly traveling through the desert. So there's like, they eat rattlesnake... They ate some goats, but no, I mean, it's all about, the Wild West, as we know, it was a place where most of the stories there are about white dudes. So it is about finding your place there when you do not look like what they want you to look like or, acquiesce the way they would like you to acquiesce.
Wake of Vultures will be out this October from Lila Bowen, a.k.a. Delilah Dawson, and her YA novel Hit is out April 14th, which means you can get it now. And Sam Sykes' novel Immortal Tally will be out later this year. It's the sequel to A City Stand Red, which is in stores now, the first book in the Bring Down Heaven series. So,
thanks so much for joining us tonight, Sam and Delilah.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having us.
What he said. Nom, nom, nom.
Nom, 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 nom.
And this has been Rocket Talk.